from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with author Rachel Urquhart about her book, The Visionist, published by Little Brown. Though she has spent much of her life living on a dairy farm in Massachusetts, Rachel Urquhart was born and raised in Manhattan. She began her magazine career at Spy and went on to work at Vogue, spending almost a decade writing and editing. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Tin House, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, Food and Wine, Vanity Fair, and other publications. She's also written three lifestyle books for the Chic Simple series, which is part of the Knopf Publishing group. It took a long time for her to begin and then complete The Visionist, her first novel. And she says her heart goes out to anyone who finds him or herself in a similar predicament. She has an MFA in fiction from Sarah Lawrence College and lives in Brooklyn with her husband and sons. Here's a little information about The Visionist, her first novel, which is about a teenage girl who finds refuge, but perhaps not, in an 1840s Shaker community. After 15-year-old Polly Kimball sets fire to the family farm, killing her abusive father, she and her young brother find shelter in a Massachusetts Shaker community called the City of Hope. It is the era of manifestations when young girls in Shaker enclaves all across the Northeast are experiencing extraordinary mystical visions, earning them the honorific of visionist and bringing renown to their settlements. The City of Hope has not yet been blessed with a visionist, but that changes when Polly arrives and is unexpectedly exalted. As she struggles to keep her dark secrets concealed in the face of increasing scrutiny, Polly finds herself in a life-changing friendship with a young Shaker sister named Charity, a girl who will stake everything, even her faith, on Polly's honesty and purity. When I spoke with Rachel Urquhart, I began by asking her to talk about the Shakers, for anyone who doesn't know very much about them, and also I asked if it's true that there is only one active Shaker community left in America. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, there's an active Shaker community in Sabbath Bay Lake, Maine, and I think the numbers, they dwindle and swell, with the years, but yeah, there are a number of people who live up there, following Shaker ideas, but also kind of bringing them into the modern world as well. The Shakers were, in spite of their isolation, they were actually quite progressive, and they believed in using the sort of technology of the day and even inventing it if it didn't exist already. So they're a funny combination of backwards in some of their views and incredibly kind of forward thinking in others.
Right. And the idea that they were always celibate seems sort of destined to extinction. So I have to assume, is the community in Maine, are they all converts to that community, or have they changed that rule?
No, I think that they do live a celibate life, which is probably one of the reasons why their numbers fluctuate, because some people can tolerate that better than others and for longer than others. But I'm sure they have not given up the celibacy. Mm-hmm. Sort of rule, as it were, of being a Shaker, just because it's so fundamental to the Shaker, belief system.
Yeah. Now, the belief system, as I understand it, was already in place when a woman who was referred to as Mother Anne joined the Shakers, but her beliefs really shaped the religion. Is that correct?
Well, she founded the religion. She came from Manchester, England, and she came to this country in 1774 with a handful of followers. They had already been persecuted in England for not being, proper Church of England. They were one of these fringe religions that, was essentially operating against the law in England. And they came here to sort of start anew. And so she really founded the religion, which is sort of unusual. I mean, you don't have that many female founders of religions really from even today, but certainly from that time.
Okay. I must have misunderstood. I thought that I read something about her joining a group that was in place, but maybe that's the community she brought with her.
And she did actually initially, when she was first experimenting with trying to find a religion that she could sort of be a part of, she joined a group called the Shaking Quakers. And they were similar to the Shakers, but she really took it a step further by adding the sort of celibacy element and a few other sort of twists that were very much came from the kind of person that she was. She was a very, very charismatic, an uneducated but very charismatic woman, and really just a force of nature. And she kind of, I think she's really the soul of Shakerism, even though it was some of the leaders that came in directly after her that really shaped the religion into a kind of viable, you know, a viable concern, really. They came up with the way the villages were going to be organized. They came up with a sort of, you know, political structure. They came up with a theology that was very, very clearly laid out. And so so she kind of, you know, got everybody excited about it, and then they took over after her death and really, I think, made it a religion that could last as long as it did and also have a kind of legacy now.
And then, so the title of your book is The Visionist, and this has to do with the kind of shaking aspect of the Shakers, the people who would see visions. But also the shaking part was also dancing and ritualistic apart from the Visionist. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that distinction is and what the Visionists were.
Sure. As you mentioned, the kind of Shakers commonly did some pretty strange things during their worship rituals, even before the religious revival that my book sort of is about. They called up the spirits of, you know, dead presidents and Indian chiefs, and, you know, they invited all kinds of spirits into their meeting and actually sort of spoke to them in these meetings and danced and had kind of communal laughing fits. I mean, you know, if you were a fly on the wall watching even an average Shaker meeting, you'd be probably pretty surprised at what you would see. The Visionists are a little different in that they were a group of teenage girls who fell into trance states and had these hallucinations, and they were very specific to this revival period that was known as the Era of Manifestations. And that period started in about 1838 and went until maybe the early 1850s. And they were seen as really sort of vessels to communicate with Mother Ann Lee in particular. And it was not every teenage girl. They were select teenage girls, but they did exist in every community, you know, slowly. It's not like they all cropped up on the same day in all the different settlements up and down the East Coast, but it sort of, as word traveled, you know, they started to sort of come out of the woodwork. And they were exalted, and they sort of got this very special title of Visionist. And they were very, very specific to this one period, though. As ecstatic as the worship ritual was before they arrived on the scene and after the revival was over, for some reason the Shakers really felt that the way these particular girls expressed themselves was different and was divine.
And that's so interesting. I'm trying to remember as we talk. I didn't even think about this while I was reading the book, but I'm trying to remember what's the time period of the Salem witch trials and the young women who had those experiences and how they were not exalted at all.
Well, yeah. I mean, I certainly was reminded of the same thing when I started to read about these girls and also took note of the fact that they were treated very, very differently within the society. It's a fascinating thing, this kind of phenomenon of young girls in particular. I mean, it's happened in a few places in the world, actually, and probably more than we know about. But, you know, there are certainly people who believe that it's a kind of almost a psychological, emotional phenomenon where it's a kind of collective hysteria and it's contagious, you know, and one teenage girl begins to behave a certain way, gets attention for it, and others sort of copy her. And it tends to happen to young girls in isolated communities, and even if, you know, as recently as, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I think there was a small town outside of Schenectady or Albany or someplace, maybe Buffalo, and there was a group of cheerleaders who all of a sudden began to behave quite strangely. They had tics, and you know, they weren't behaving the way they had previously, and it seemed kind of similar in a funny way to the women in the Salem witch trials, to a group of girls in an African village that's documented as sort of laughing for months on end and not stopping. You know, it's kind of happened before in these isolated communities, and so one explanation is that it's this kind of contagious hysteria. I definitely struggled the whole time I wrote this book, you know, were the visionists real or were they not? And in the end, although I consider myself to be a pretty skeptical person, I believed that sort of that there were girls amongst, you know, all the teenage girls who came forward as visionists. You know, there were some complete fakes, but I did sort of believe that some of them really did have an ability to, I don't know if communicate is the right word, but just sort of enter into a world that we have no access to. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe spending so much time studying the Shakers, as practical as they are, I think they also, they had this ability to sort of, I don't know, allow themselves to go into these other places that made me think hard about all the things we can't explain in this life. And that made the possibility of a real visionist much easier to, you know, to think about. So it's an interesting kind of learning curve.
Yeah, and I was surprised to read in your blog that you were new to fiction when you began working on this book. It was fascinating. It felt very historically possible, and it was completely riveting. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your three narrative voices. One of the things that really impressed me as I read the book was that you know, despite the fact that all of these three narrators would have lived 200 years ago, and so you had to create a language for them and a thought process that reflected the times, they were all very different. You didn't just sort of fall into a 200-year-old language pattern. You know, I mean, the three voices are Simon's, Polly's, and Charity's, all very, very different narrators. So I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about creating those voices.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very nice of you to say what you said about the language, because I worked really hard on that, so thank you.
Good.
But my feeling is, and it wasn't even a conscious decision in some ways, just to address the issue of kind of language, period language, I knew that I wanted to tell this story in a language that evoked, I wanted the language to evoke the time as much as the actual events of the story. And so I kind of studied how people spoke and found all these beautiful words that, you know, are no longer in use in our language. And I tried to kind of create almost a patois, you know, combination of contemporary expression, just because none of us have the patience to read through the very circuitous way of talking that sort of secular people used in those days. And then in terms of Shakers, you know, I would never have had the patience to write dialogue that included a lot of these and thous and, you know, on the sort of more religious type of speaking.
Yes.
And so I tried to kind of, you know, create this hybrid that would take people back, but not be too distracting and not use too many kind of words that were sort of ye olde words, you know. So it was a balancing act, definitely. And then in terms of the voices of the characters, I It made sense to me, for example, that Polly, who is an abused and traumatized teenager, that she would address, you know, would sort of tell herself her own story a little bit from a distance, because, you know, it just would be sort of too close for her to be in first person, you know, sort of saying, I did this, I did that. So I put her voice in a kind of close third person, yeah, as if she's kind of at a little bit of a remove from her life. And also that made the moments when she slips into hallucinations a lot more, you know, a lot, if they felt more real to write them that way. Yeah. You know, you can't have somebody saying, and then I saw an angel, and then I saw a crab walking upside down, or, you know, it kind of kills it. So that is how her voice came about. And Charity just felt, because she's a Shaker, as though she would address the audience in the first person, or not the audience, but her reader and the world in the first person, just because it seemed the most plain-spoken way for her to express herself. And what was a little bit tricky was trying to work with the fact that although she's such an honest character, she ends up sort of misleading herself by, you know, by sort of buying in wholesale to the Shaker faith, which, you know, is a risk anyone takes when they, you know, when they join a religion, especially one that's as extreme as the Shakers were. Mm-hmm. And so there was a kind of tension there between what, you know, the truth that she appeared to be speaking and the, you know, the lies that she ends up sort of telling herself in order to exist in this community. So I tried to play a little bit with that, with her. Yeah. And then Simon Sire, really, he came out of just a world of newspaper writings and, you know, that I read from that time, and an almost kind of Americanized sort of, yeah, Dickensian, yeah, character, how I thought that person might speak. So that's kind of where all that came from.
Now, one thing that I thought about while I was reading this, which I thought was absolutely either organically or purposefully brilliant, your narrators all are observing something. So Polly is watching over her shoulder because she's actually trying to escape a past. And Charity is always watching for signs of affection. And Simon, as an investigator, is always looking for clues. So they just make fantastic narrators, all three of them, even though, again, they're so different. So I really, I enjoyed thinking about that. I don't know if that was on purpose or...
Well, actually, I never was able to articulate it to myself so clearly, but I think that's very much this idea of them looking over their shoulders at something is very true, and I just hadn't thought of it that way. It's a great way to think about it, and I definitely in other words, I don't know that I did it totally on purpose, but now that you say it, it sounds really, really it sounds like what I was trying to do. I just wasn't smart enough to put it into those words in describing it. But I do think they all, I mean, they are propelled by, you know, whether it's issues in their present, like Charity has this very strange skin affliction that she is sure has come about because she is evil, because she thinks she is evil. And, you know, so that's a sort of present-day thing that shapes her view of the world. Or Polly, who is just living this kind of double life where she feels she's one thing, which is to say a kind of sullied, sinful girl who's, you know, had all manner of terrible things done to her and therefore must be a kind of broken soul, and yet she's exalted into this divine being by the Shakers. So she's living this kind of double life, and Simon he's a character who's really haunted by his past and trying to find some way to redeem, not so much himself, I think, but really redeem his past, you know,
yeah,
the events of his past, and kind of and turn things around.
And whether or not he's trying to redeem himself in some true sense, he's definitely trying to have his story retold because it's been told inaccurately, and it So I, as I got to the end of the book, I had a glance at your bibliography, and I was really impressed. I was like, wow, you did a lot of research. I was wondering if you researched and wrote at the same time, or did you do all of that reading ahead of time before you started writing? How did that work for you?
You know, it was a little bit of a mix. I mean, the whole way that it came about that I wrote this book is that somebody told me that I should write about the Shakers. It was somebody who didn't know me particularly well. And I sort of thought, well, yeah, very nice idea. Thank you very much. Because I never would have imagined that I would have written about the Shakers. I never would have imagined that I would have written a period novel. Mm-hmm. And then he told me about these two books that he'd seen in a secondhand bookstore. So I went and picked them up, and they, that's how I first read about The Era of Manifestations and this incredible story of these teenage girls being elevated to this sort of amazing position in Shaker society, and the very sort of odd ways that they behaved, and a kind of, a whole picture of the Shakers came into focus for me that really I had no idea about before I read these two books. And so literally within moments of sort of reading all that stuff, it sounds so corny, but it was almost as if I had a kind of vision of a story that could come about based on, you know, all these facts that were sort of hitting me for the first time. And so I actually did write a little bit without knowing very much, just to get a feel for what the characters might sound like, and then I kind of put it all away and just thought, okay, I've got to find out more about the Shakers. So I read a lot about Shakers in general. And then I realized I really want to narrow down to this particular time. And so I read a lot about this particular revival. And then I, you know, went even narrower still, and especially when I would visit the various Shaker sites, especially Hancock Shaker Village in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which is an amazing place to visit. Mm. Yeah, I kind of started just to put myself in their shoes as I walked through the rooms, and I took photographs and notes, and so the research really, and at that point I really was writing while I was researching. So I would say I kept reading right up until the very, very last, you know, comma of the last rewrite, just because it was sort of impossible to stay away. And yet, you know, obviously there were times when I had to sit down and just, you know, write. And so it was a little bit of a combination, but certainly in the beginning it leaned more towards the research, just because I really needed to learn a lot about the Shakers, to get a sense of how I might paint a fictional world in such a way that wouldn't discredit, you know, all the people who have come before and written really scholarly works about the Shakers.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you a journalist before you wrote this?
I was. I always hesitate to call myself a journalist. I was a magazine writer, and although that required some journalism skills, I always think of journalists as, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners and people who go off into war zones. And I very definitely was not writing that kind of journalism. But I was lucky enough to be able to make a living at, first of all, a satirical magazine called Spy Magazine, which is no longer in existence, but was an incredible place to begin as a journalist. And then I had a long stint at Vogue, first as a writer and then as an editor, and that was an amazing experience because I really got to work on, you know, I think I was a magazine writer because I needed to work on my writing. I needed to kind of learn how to put words together. And so I kind of didn't concentrate so much on my subject. You know, it was definitely style over substance with me when I was a magazine writer. And I don't really mind that because I really felt the whole time that I was practicing with the idea that someday, if I was lucky, I could do what I really wanted to do, which was write fiction. So So it worked out well. I mean, it was definitely not the most direct route to take to becoming a fiction writer, but it just helped to be kind of a journeyman writer for as long as I was, because then when it came to writing this book, that was one thing I didn't have to struggle with. I had to learn a lot about writing a novel and about plot and about all kinds of things, but I didn't really feel that I had to struggle too much with the idea of rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I rewrote this book a million times. And so it was nice to have some of those skills under my belt, and that's entirely because of the time I spent writing for magazines.
Now, you Was this your first book, or do you have one in a drawer somewhere that you?
Oh God, I wish I did. I would help me so much right now if I did. No, this is my first novel. I had to write a thesis. I got my MFA in fiction writing from Sarah Lawrence. Quite a long time after I graduated college, it was a sort of moment where I thought, well, if I want to be a fiction writer, I got to see what it's like to write fiction. And so I went to school, and but that thesis is a collection of extremely short stories. I think the longest one is maybe 15 pages. So I never thought that I could actually, you know, go the distance of writing a novel. I figured I might, if I was lucky, become a short story writer or something. But then this was material that really demanded a longer form. So I got kind of lucky in that way.
Okay.
But no, I don't have a novel in a drawer, and I'm attempting to bring out one now or to sort of summon one in my head now. And it's definitely very scary to sort of start anew.
Yeah, I bet. The other thing I loved about this novel, which you must have been so thrilled, is the cover. The cover is amazing, and I just wanted to talk about it for a minute because it's unlike most covers out there. It's this. I think this is the photograph is from Pittsfield, right? You got it from
Hancock Shaker Village, and so it's an Eldris who there happened to be this incredible photograph of a quite beautiful young Eldris, and so that was a very lucky thing.
And then in front of her photograph, there's like this parchment type of actual book cover that's almost transparent, not quite, and it has a kind of golden tree growing on it, and then the title and your name, but her face is just almost visible behind it. It's very haunting. Were you thrilled? I mean,
I was over the moon when they sent me the mock-up of the cover. I had nothing to do with the cover, which is why I feel completely comfortable saying I absolutely adore the cover of my book. It was designed by one of the designers at Little Brown, a man named Keith Hayes, and I was just so... It's an incredible experience when you see a total stranger's visual representation of what you've spent, in my case, 10 years, writing down. And what I loved about it was that he captured, the leaves that you mentioned are a kind of, it's a kind of version of the Shaker Tree of Life that he put in gold leaf on the vellum, sort of cloudy vellum cover that you described. And what I love about that tree is that it seems to be sort of, it's a very beautiful thing, and yet she seems also to be vaguely sort of being like strangled by the vines.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just felt like he was able to portray so much of, the beauty of being part of a religion like the Shakers, and yet the kind of rigidity and constriction of it. And so every aspect of the cover just blew me away. And you're right, I don't see a lot of covers out there that look like that. So I'm so grateful to Little Brown for having just putting that kind of face on the book. It's been an incredible thing.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit more about Simon Pryor. Part of what interested me about this character was he's a 19th century investigator. Now, this book is not like a standard murder mystery that's being plopped into another time period, but follows the same the same kind of course of action as a modern mystery. The mystery of this story has really got to do with secrets and people's backgrounds and things that are unfolded gradually. But Simon Pryor doesn't know everything that's happened, and he's an investigator who we sort of see figuring everything out. I loved this observation by him early in the narrative. He says, "Men will tell you where, women will tell you what, and sharp-eyed children will fill in everything in between." I thought there was some truth to that. Once I thought about it, I'm like, absolutely. Men like maps and directions and locations, and women like stories, and children like just to feel helpful. That was such a great... So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about developing Simon's character as an investigator in his time period, which I thought was kind of neat.
Yeah, Simon's character was the last one to come to me, and he was really difficult for me at first. I couldn't get his voice quite right. At one point, his story was entirely expressed through letter writing, which didn't work at all. I mean, he was really a complicated third, he was the sort of last piece of all in the place. And actually, I need to give credit where credit is due. I actually loved that observation as well, and I can say that because I read it there was a man whose name I don't remember, but he was not a famous man. He just wrote a description about what it was like to investigate a rural fire versus investigating a fire that takes place in a city.
Okay.
And this was a document from the 1950s, and he really just had these amazing insights into how you go about interviewing people to try to get the real story when there's been a fire.
And, so did he also say there's hardly, well, not this exact quote, but did he also say something along the lines of there's hardly a person alive who can resist correcting another man's mistake?
I think I said that one.
I
might be able to take credit for that one, but a lot of the other things in that particular section where Simon is describing essentially how he does his work, I got from this amazing man who wasn't the best writer in the world, but he had such a tone, and that was such that he opened the door for me onto Simon's character and how knowing he is about human behavior, and kind of once I realized that that's who Simon was, I was able to have so much more fun with his observations about the world in lots of other situations, and those did actually come straight from me. But I just wanted to say that I didn't copy everything from other people. But it just made me realize that Simon's learned a lot from life, and some of it comes just from being very good at what he does as an investigator. But some of it is just being a sharp observer of human behavior, and
yeah.
And that was really, really fun. It kind of made me love writing him in a way that I didn't until I had that kind of, that moment.
Well, it's funny because actually it's. Another thing that's funny is that he himself, Simon himself, makes an observation toward the end of the novel about being at the mercy of cliché. And actually, mm-hmm. I liked that sentence, too. He says something about being at the mercy of cliché and the threadbare language of exaltation, which I won't go into detail because it gives too much away. But I think that when you're writing an investigator, you are at the mercy of cliché. You are trying so hard to come up with something original, which is why I suspect that would be one reason that he would have been so hard to come to. Do you think
yeah,
maybe
that absolutely? No, you're totally right. And and also there's the very certainly obvious to me fact that it's one thing to have never written a novel before, but it's really something to have never written anything involving an investigator or some form of detective story. I don't think of my book as a detective story, but there happens to be a character who is a detective in it, and so it has elements of that. And you're so right. It's so easy to fall into the kind of, the sort of habits of people who've done it so much better, but to kind of, there's just a style that goes with that territory. And I think in a funny way, I was lucky that I wasn't trying to write a detective story. I
Right.
was trying to write a novel that had a detective as one of its main characters. And that's what I was able to hang on to,
Right.
because otherwise I would have been completely out of my depth. I do not know how to write a detective story.
I should say, too, that he's a fire investigator. He's not a cop. And he, and absolutely, it's not just sort of like a copy of the hard-boiled detective mystery, nothing like that at all. But he was a lot of fun to read. So,
I'm glad. Yeah, I'm glad about that.
At one point, your character, Sister Charity, talks about the devil residing in books where only sin and fantasy can be set forth. And it's funny, in this story, there is a certain book that shakes her confidence in her beliefs. But it seems like there's a lot of religion that will have this attitude towards books, you know, that books are evil, you know. And what are your thoughts on this, just as a writer, and why certain religions are so fearful of the book?
Well, I think that that any religion, that especially one that's organized as the Shaker religion is and was, it fears not having total control over the information that is, you know, coming in and potentially influencing its flock of believers. And so for the Shakers, I think they just cut out the normal world as much as they could in every way possible, because I think they really didn't want the believers sort of hearing about how much fun it was to travel the world, or how great it was to be in love, or, you know, all these things that they were certainly never going to be allowed to do as Shakers. And so I think that books were threatening to the kind of, you know, leadership of the Shakers, just when they thought about how they were going to get everybody to band together and make the sacrifices that they asked of their believers. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing, I think. And I also think that they honestly felt that, I mean, they felt that they called the world outside of their walls the world, capital T, capital W. And I think that they already thought the world was sinful enough in reality to then take it to a level where it was maybe an imagined version of the world. I think that just was, you know, they couldn't tolerate that idea at all, because who knew what was going to come out of somebody's imagining of the world, somebody's fantasy of what might happen in the world. And so I think they were just very aware that something like a book could be a dangerous thing. And they're certainly not the first, as you said, they're not the first or only people to feel that way about books. And it goes on to, you know, to this day, you know.
Right, sure. And political movements and religions, yeah.
And, yeah, extreme religions. So it was fascinating. But, you know, they didn't really want any influence from the outside world coming in. I mean, they didn't allow or really any thoughts, personal thoughts, to be put down onto paper by the believers. There are a few Shakers who managed to keep personal journals, and thank goodness for them, because they show us an aspect of Shaker life that we could never get from the much drier and more sort of practical journals that the Shakers kept, just to sort of, you know, record the animals that were slaughtered that day, kind of thing. But the Shakers were not even allowed to keep personal journals. They were not allowed to write down anything in any color but black ink. You know, there were so many rules, and it's, you know, I think it was just they had to set up a system that, you know, where you really were told exactly what to do at every minute of the day, so that nobody, you know, stepped off the line, you know.
Yeah.
And that was really the only way you were going to get these people to be able to live together.
Okay. Now, you talked before about having revised and revised and revised. I'm curious, at what point in your personal experience of writing this book did you get a publishing contract? And then after that, what was the editing process like at that point?
Sure. I really didn't show this book to anyone except for my agent, who happens to be remarkable in many ways, but one way in particular is that she's an amazing editor, and so she and teacher in my
yeah.
case. So I worked very closely with her throughout, you know, revision after revision after revision, and I didn't have a writing group except in the very, very beginning for the first 20 pages, but I didn't. I hardly even showed it to my husband. I think there was a point fairly late on in the process where I showed it to I showed 70 pages to some friends just to find out if they were even vaguely interested in these characters. But that's kind of where I was. I was really writing this book in isolation. You know, it was very surprising to me when it was finally ready, when my agent finally said, okay, let's just try this, you know. And she definitely said, I have no idea what's going to happen. You know, it's a dark book. It's got multiple points of view, which is sometimes very hard to sell, because if an editor kicks against one of your characters' voices, you're sunk. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's a crazy market, and I can't predict what's going to happen. So I was really, really ready for this not to go anywhere. And what happened was very surprising, which is that the editors that she did choose to send it to, many of them responded very positively, and then somehow, weirdly enough, the word got out and people started requesting that she send it to them. And Little Brown, which really it was Regan Arthur, who is now publisher of Little Brown, but who at that point was an editor with her own imprint that was published by Little Brown. And she just was incredible. From the very beginning, she seemed to know right away that she wanted my book, and she stayed on it. She just kept calling my agent and saying, really, you know, please let me know everything that's happening with this book. And in the end, I had a discussion with my agent before the book was potentially going to kind of get into an auction situation. And I just said I'd rather be with an editor who's really passionate about it and who's going to work on it than be with somebody that isn't going to give me the net of their expertise, you know, as an editor. So I ended up in the best possible hands, and I couldn't be happier. Yeah. And then after it was sold, you know, they gave me some incredible editorial comments, which they were very nice about saying, you know, please don't pay attention to any of these if you don't want to. And, of course, they were so good, and I had had so few people read the book that I hadn't had that kind of specific line reading before. And so I sat down with their comments and the comments of my British editor at Simon & Schuster, and then a few family members who read it and gave comments, and I just annotated an entire manuscript on paper with everybody's comments, and then I sat down and I rewrote the entire book before I handed it in for the final time. And in fact, I think Little Brown was even pretty shocked that it came in so completely rewritten, because I don't think they expected anything like that. And I think it could have gone horribly wrong, but I was paying such close attention to what they said because it made so much sense, and they kind of caught out all the things that I knew weren't quite right, but I was sort of hoping nobody would notice, kind of thing. And as a writer, you know, that's what you have to do to get across the finish line. But as somebody who eventually actually now knows that she's going to have a book that's put out into the world, you really want someone to catch you out on all those things so that you have a chance to fix them and make it better. And so because of everything that they did for me, I was able to, I think, change the book, you know, just hugely for the better.
So when you say you rewrote it after getting everybody's notes, define rewrite. I mean, like, literally, you sat down without a draft at your elbow and rewrote it?
No, I sat down with the existing draft, but every single paragraph was, I would say, well, no, let's say 90% of the paragraphs in the book had either had some change, and I don't just mean like a comma put in or a word taken out. I mean, there were, of course, a lot of those kinds of changes, but, you know, there were all kinds of little things. Like, I realized that I had last sentences on a lot of my paragraphs that were just totally unnecessary. They were there for me to kind of feel like I'd wrapped up an idea in a nice, tidy, pretty
sentence.
Isn't
that interesting? Huh?
But the reader already knew. You know, they got it. And I had to, once I realized that sort of embarrassing pattern and how vain it was, really, of me, you know, it was just sort of like my chance to do a nice little wrap-up sentence. And I realized that as I went through each paragraph, I was like, oh, my God, there's another. And I just started drawing lines through whole sentences at the end of almost every paragraph. And I told that to my mother-in-law, who's an art historian and has written some huge books on everyone from Frida Kahlo to, you know, Arshil Gorky. And she said, you know, I was looking at this book I'm writing, and I do that too. So it was kind of great. It was like this little secret I was sort of let in on. And so there were, and then there were whole characters who changed. I mean, elder sister Agnes, who is I don't know how much of a description you want me to give of her, but she's a complicated character.
She is.
Sort of most powerful shaker, kind of almost like a mother superior type of character within the community. And she is very suspicious of Polly's, you know, potential abilities as a visionist, but she's also really trying to protect her flock. And, you know, she's a complicated character, and
she
really changed a lot in that last revision, because I had written her meaner and more evil than I ever wanted her to
be. Oh, that's so interesting, because I was thinking that she's an excellent character, because just when you start to feel like you can comfortably dislike her, because really we're on Polly's side through the whole book, she right. becomes sort of sympathetic for a minute, and then you're like, oh, wait, I don't know what's going on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I really, I always liked her. I couldn't get enough distance on her to write her in the complex way that I really wanted to. And it was only with some help from people who kind of told me what things weren't working for them and that I could sort of begin to find my way to a character who, you know, who is sympathetic ultimately, because, you know, her intentions are completely true and honest. It's just that she does things that, especially in our, you know, in terms of looking at it from where we are now, you know, they're unthinkable. I mean, she's the one that hands Polly's mother the contract of indenture and demands that Polly's mother sign over her children, which the Shakers did. You know, she's the one that suspects Polly all through the book. She's the one that, she's the one that's very interested in trying to get, you know, there's a plot that involves land in the book, and she's the one that's really eager to get her hands on that land for the Shaker community, and that is something the Shakers did. They were very, very astute about buying up land so that they could farm it and, you know, produce what they needed to produce, not only for their own communities, but for poor people in the cities, and you know, so
right.
it wasn't an entirely selfish enterprise. But anyway, so she did kind of go back and forth, I think, in the readers' minds. And yet I've had readers who say they absolutely hated her. It was sort of like a, you know, as soon as she separates May from her children, you know, Polly and Ben, they were like, okay, we don't like this woman.
Yeah.
She's impossible to like. So it's kind of funny. People have had different responses to her.
Yeah, I don't think I ever really liked her, but I didn't find her to be duplicitous. She's very honest about what she's doing, and she has her goals, and she has her beliefs, and she's very out there with them. So I could respect her when I didn't like her. In a way.
Right, and she genuinely loves Sister Charity. I mean, she can't always show it, but she genuinely is just worried about what's going to happen to this innocent Shaker sister if she
yeah.
gets too much information from the world outside the Shaker walls and is influenced in some way by it. So, you know, I think that also sort of redeemed her in people's minds a bit.
Yeah. Okay, great. I just wondered if you can talk at all yet about what you're working on now, or if you're not quite ready to do that yet. I don't know.
Well, I can talk about it very generally. Unfortunately, the reason for that is that I just am not anywhere near as far along as I'd like to be. But basically, I'm not writing another period novel. I'm writing a contemporary novel. I think, as far as I know, as far as I am hearing it in my head anyway at this point, it will be another multi-narrator book. And it's really sort of about the gifts and burdens of legacy and how the past kind of, you know, can really affect who we think we are, but then, you know, it can also, if we take a slightly different view of it, it can also change, you know, who we think we are. So it's that's not a very clear description, but that's basically what it's about.
And, well, that's intriguing.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It's going to be, it's a little scary, to tell you the truth, to decide to write a novel and not have the crutch of a group that is as fascinating as the Shakers proved to be. And so I'm a little concerned about how that's going to go. But you know, it's time. I think it's time for me to, you know, let the Shakers go and let other people work with them. And you know, they've given me a lot, and now I gotta move on and see if I can do this all by myself. So it does feel sort of like I'm letting go of a major partner, sort of, and going it alone, which is scary. But
yeah,
we'll see.
I can imagine. I just wanted to ask if you're reading anything right now. Sometimes when people are on these book tours, they don't have time to read, but are you reading anything that you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, you know, this book I've been recommending to people, and I recommend it so strongly that people start to kind of back away, like as if I'm a little bit crazy. There's a trilogy that's been translated by an editor at The New Yorker from Italian into English, and it's by a writer named Elena Ferrante. It's spelled F-E-R-R-A-N-T-E. And the first book of the trilogy is called My Brilliant Friend. And I've only read the two that have been translated, and I cannot wait for the third to be translated. I loved these books. They're really about a relationship between two girls. It starts in the 1940s in a poor suburb of Naples, and the characters are so complex, and yet it's such unpretentious writing and such unpretentious storytelling. It took my breath away, and it's at first it seems like a very simple book, and you kind of think, why did the person who recommended this to me recommend it? And then you get to kind of, you know, the end of the first chapter, and you realize, wow, there's a lot going on here. And so I've loved that, you know, the two books of that trilogy that I've read.
Okay. Lately, I've been asking people for specific advice for writers. Like, I might ask you, what's your advice for writing period historical fiction? And then a lot of people lately have been saying, well, I don't have advice about that, but I have advice about this. So I'm going to just generally ask you if you have any advice for listeners who are writers, because a lot of the listeners are writers.
Yeah, I actually do, which amazes me that I do, because, you know, I'm 50, almost 51, and so this book was written very late in my life compared to, you know, the writers you read about and feel intense envy about. And so I never really imagined I'd be in a position where I had advice. And I think one of the main things that I feel is that one thing that kept me from writing for so long, or from trying to write fiction, I should say, is that I thought there was a really specific way to be a writer. I thought that you had to keep a journal. I thought that you had to feel like you were going to die if you didn't write every day. I thought you had to write every day. I had all these rules in my head that seemed to be how to be, you know, an excellent writer. And I didn't do any of them. And so I thought, well, I must not be a literary writer. And I think what I really learned in this process is, I had to make up my own rules, you know, and one of them ended up being that I just had to persevere. I discovered a kind of perseverance that I never, ever knew I had. So that was sort of one thing I realized. I didn't necessarily have to be regularly persevering, but I had to constantly go back. I had to force myself to go back. And even if I left the book for 3 months, which I did on occasion, just not touch it for 3 months, I just had to know that I was going to go back and continue working. And then the other thing I learned is that you can work on a book without writing it. And I do that a lot. And which is to say that I go for a run and I say, you know, you have to think about this specific scene for the entire run. And so I would just tell myself the story of the scene in, you know, as many ways as I could sort of think of and work through it that way. And when I couldn't even do that, I would just say, well, you have to go see other artists. You know, you have to go see an exhibit of paintings, you know, that will kind of remind you what you're shooting for, and or listen to. I make playlists, you know, that weren't at all like soundtrack to the movie type playlists. They just were songs that reminded me of the emotion that I wanted to create in a certain scene. And I just found that, you know, approaching the book from, you know, when one door seemed sort of completely locked to me, I just had to kind of find any other door I could into the work, and sometimes that didn't involve writing, and that was a huge relief when I realized that. And then I guess the last thing I could go on actually for quite a long time, but one last thing is that I really realized when I was writing this book that I had to edit out certain things, not so much the distractions in my life, but really, you know, I stopped reading contemporary fiction because it scared me too much while I was trying to write period fiction. I just thought, wow, my book isn't hip, my book isn't postmodern, you know, and so I cut out everything that scared me. I stopped reading book reviews because if they were good, I thought, oh, I'll never get a book review like that, and if they were bad, I thought, oh my God, look at what can happen when they hate your book. So I cut out reading book reviews. I just kind of created a moat around myself that that made it safe to kind of forge ahead at my late stage in the game. And I think especially for women writers, actually, it's really important to set your own rules, because the same rules do not apply for women writers as for men. And I think that has a lot to do with just the things that we, you know, even in our modern day and age, even with wonderful men out there willing to do a lot more than previous generations of men have been willing to do, you got to take care of an awful lot before you feel as though you're allowed to sit down and write your book. And so I think sort of giving myself permission to sit down and write, and actually then going one step further and saying, no, actually, you know what, we're eating pizza tonight because I need to work all day on is important, you know, is my job. And just taking myself seriously. A friend of mine called it, you know, writing like a man. One day she said to me in a moment when I was extremely kind of, oh my God, I can't go on. She just said, Rach, sit down, write like a man. And I thought, you know, I just wish I'd had a T-shirt made up, you know, of that, because it really was sort of what I had to do. I had to put myself in that head instead of the head that was worried about taking care of everybody.
Yes, that is awesome.
So anyway, that's more than you asked for.
No, but if we hadn't done the whole thing, we wouldn't have gotten to the write like a man, and I need that T-shirt too. That's awesome. I love it.
Good.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I'm going to just say once more that the novel is The Visionist. It's published by Little Brown. My guest was Rachel Urquhart. Thank you so much. This is really a pleasure. I so enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, I loved it too. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Rachel Urquhart, and you can learn more about her work at Rachel Urquhart, which is U-R-Q-U-H-A-R-T, writer.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview you heard today and the Shaker community. Invent a group that has diminished from a large, possibly powerful organization or community to something smaller with minimal influence. What does this group look like? What happened to change their situation? What characters come to mind when you consider this scenario? And how might each of them react to their change in size and scope? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion.
A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. I'd love your feedback about the show. Book podcasts really are a mix, so if you feel that we do this well, we would love to know about that. Please be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. If you do like the show, please rate it to where you find it. Leave a review. Talk about it. You can visit Write the Book on social media sites, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. Up next at 5 o'clock, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.